dome, the city is destroyed.
Right. The difference is in Sodom, the city is destroyed. In our case, and the guests are angels. In our case, the guest is the Levi, who's no angel himself, no question. And the city ultimately will be destroyed, but not by God, but rather by man. So there is a certain parallel that will come later in the story, that the city gets destroyed, but in different contexts. What else makes the story of Sodom different from the story of Pelegish Begiva?
When do the doors close, supposedly around Lot's house, so that there are no doors and they don't know where to get in and where to get out?
Oh, I don't know about the doors. The text says that the angels smote the people with blindness. So that's what the text says. Beyond that, the Midrashim have all kinds of discussions as to what that happened there. But the result, what takes place next, is dramatically different. In the case of Lot, the angels saved them. In the case of the Zakein, the Sheol ends up becoming a victim. The result, post this conversation, the two stories diverge into completely different stories altogether. Right. Sodom is destroyed. We ended up in a civil war. Completely different stories. So it's really hard to compare what happens next. The comparison that we are focusing on right now is on the offer of the daughters, the surrounding of the city, and the conversation that takes place. So far we've identified the differences as the nature of the man, what happens to the daughters, what else is, or the difference in terms of who's being offered. What else is significantly different in these two conversations?
I don't know if it's different, but is it from the atmosphere that we know that being hospitable to your guests is not really being hospitable to your guests, because we're really not we're not really doing the nicest thing, but we have to know that from the atmosphere, because he is saying, "Don't touch my guest," you know.
Right, no, I think that there's a perversion of the value of Echnasat Orchim in both cases. That's true. In the case of Lot, the perversion comes from the fact that he's in the middle of the city of Sodom, which is known for its xenophobia. Chet of Sodom is essentially known for its xenophobia. So the notion that he's being hospitable, kind of carrying over the legacy of Avraham, but then perverting it. You'd never imagine Avraham doing such a having such a conversation. And a similar phenomenon happening in Givah, where the people of Givah are behaving in a manner which is reminiscent of Sodom, inhospitable to the Levi. Comes along this Ish HaZaken, and like Lot, sort of a remnant of the world of Achnasat Orchim, and yet perverted. So there is that context in which the value of Achnasat Orchim is being so dramatically perverted. That is true. Going back to the earlier conversation about the parallels. What other differences are there between these two stories? Because I want to go to the Ramban, and the Ramban is going to compare and contrast them for us, so I want to do that exercise first. What other aspects of the story, both textual or thematic, are different? We've highlighted the parallels. Let's talk a little bit about the differences. Who's the perpetrator? I don't mean the man or the guest, but from the people surrounding the house. How are the perpetrators described?
Well, in Sodom, it was the city that was the residence of Sodom.
Right. In the Sodom, it was the residence of Sodom, and Shei Sodom, which are then given an adjective or a description of Minar ve'ad zaken v'chol ha'am, young to old, every corner of the city, meaning that surrounding that house of Lot was
all
the residents of Sodom. You need an extra copy?
No,
of it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All the residents of Sodom. Whereas in the case of Pilagesh or Givah, and Shei Ha'ir and Shei B'nei Belial, people of the city, worthless people. So it doesn't tell us that they're all of the people of the city. It describes them as evil people of the city of Givah. Does that mean all the people of Givah or some of the people of Givah? It's unclear. but it certainly does not include, it omits almost intentionally the parallel phrase, because every other part of those two psukim, if you look in the middle, from Yutet Dalet on the right and Chafet, every other part of that pasuk is virtually identical. The only part of that pasuk that differs is the part where on the right hand side by Sodom it says Mina v'ad zaken v'chol ha'am mikatzeh. That description of the totality, everybody from Sodom. Whereas by us, it's Anshe Ha'ir, Anshe B'nei Belial. So that's...
Then you can't tell everybody in...
Yeah.
You can't tell. Great, you can't tell. Correct. You cannot tell.
We don't really know that.
We don't know. That is correct.
And all the people in the city, what do you think there were? I mean, you think there were hundreds?
I mean, nobody else offered...
In the Sodom, it's, in the case of Sodom, it says, it tells us, Mina V'yad Zaken Tafen, Mina V'yad Zaken Kol Ha'am Mikatzeh. I don't know about the women and children, but certainly all of the men, right? All of the people of the city rose up in protest. Whereas by us, it talks about Anshe Ha'ir, Anshe B'nei Belial. Is it all the people of the city or a subset? Unclear. For now, I believe that is an open question.
But actually, it then draws a similarity.
Which is?
Because all those involved from both places are evil or...
So interesting, by Pilagesh, it describes them as such, Anshe B'nei Belial. It doesn't describe them as such as Sodom. All it says is Anshe Sodom. It doesn't need to. Why?
Because we know.
Because Sodom is already described in Parshat Lech Lecha. This is the beginning of Parshat Vayera. In Parshat Lech Lecha, when Lot chooses to go to Sodom, it tells us, Anshe Ve'ir Sodom, it tells us, a very detailed description of Sodom, and I'll read you the pasuk. So the anshei Sodom, the people of Sodom, ra'im v'chata'im la'Hashem ma'od. Evil, sinning people to God very much. And we already talked about the fact that lo yadu et Hashem may be a little different, but they're certainly described as ha'im v'chata'im la'Hashem, evil, wicked people. So that description we already have doesn't necessarily have to repeat it. All you have to do is say, dealing with Sodom, but we know what Sodom means and what Sodom represents. Okay.
Were there really a lot of cities where all these, I mean, like we have these that mention of Sodom. Were there other cities just like this or only Sodom?
Well, how would you describe Giv'ah?
Okay. Besides the two that we're describing.
Oh. Besides the two that we're describing, that's a very good question. That's an excellent question. Besides the two that we're describing...
Because you're making them out to be really awful, awful.
Right. And that's fair, considering the fact that I didn't have to embellish the text very much to make them awful, awful.
They are awful, awful.
That's
cute. I just want to know, were there others
right.
in the same
boat? We don't know of any other story in Tanakh that is as parallel to the events that we described here. These two events are certainly described in detail. We do know, and I will show you B'zrat Hashem at the end of the shir today, we do know that that Sodom and Amora were always perceived as paradigms of evil, and therefore the Nevi'im used them often as a threat to nations, evil nations surrounding us, or a threat to Israel. If you don't improve, I will do to you what I did to Sodom. That threat permeates all the Nevi'im. But a detailed description of a behavioral pattern that equals or is similar to the behavioral pattern that we know of from Sodom, that we have only two events in Tanakh of similar style, Lot and the Pilegesh, which leads the Mefarshim, as it's leading us, to an intuitive and an immediate compare and contrast. You've heard this from me many times, that this is a powerful example. Every comparison in Tanakh begs the contrast. Because to some extent, it's the contrast, it's the details, or the significance are in the subtle details of the differences, not the similarities. And the moment I have 20 parallels, and then I have two or three unique differences, Those are what stand out and man, require of us or mandate of us to kind of say, okay, well, where do they differ? And where are they similar? So the Ramban is really one of the first to go through this parallel extensively. He does so in his Perush on Chumash and Parsha Vayera, which he's trying to understand the story of Lot and compares it to the story of the Pilegesh. In so doing, he raises for us an interesting moral question. Which of the two evil stories is worse? Correct. Now that's a really powerful question. So let's take a look at this one, Ben, and let's see what he does with it. And
are we going to ask for
excuse me? Are we going to guess? Well, we'll guess afterwards. We're going to guess. We're going to guess by asking ourselves what is probably a dangerous question. But that question is: do you agree or disagree with the Ramban?
That's harder.
So, if you turn the page over, I believe it's on the back side of this of this chart. It's a long one. We're only going to tackle the first third. The rest of it is relevant for the rest of the story, so we'll come back to it when we get to the rest of the story. We haven't looked at the war yet, so it's hard for us to assess his discussion of the war since we haven't read it yet. But his discussion of the parallel of the Chet is in the opening two-thirds of the first column. So that's what I wanted to do today. The Ramban is on the pasuk in the context of Lot of Otziana Eten Alechem, when Lot offers his two daughters to the people of Sdom as a kind of consolation prize. And he says the following: Mitoch shivcho shel ha'ish hazeh banu lidei gnuto. In the middle of discussing the story and in attempting to or express the praise of this man, that he was so hospitable, Lot, that he went out to the guests and he brought them in and he's defending his guests, in the meantime, kind of like the ultimate backhanded compliment, the text expresses the criticism of this man. In other words, we're trying to praise him, and in the end, we end up
damning him.
What's Gnuto is damning?
Gnut is negative, and Shvach is positive. Huh. So, mitoch shivcho, banu lidei gnuto. We're trying to be positive, or we're discussing something, his effort to be positive, and in the end, it turns out to be ultimately to his discredit. Why? On the one hand, he's trying desperately to care for his guests, to save them, because his guests are under his protection. They're his guests. He's responsible for them. Aval, sheyefayes anshei ha'ir, but that he should appease the desires of the people of the city, behefker benotav, by allowing his daughters to be given away so haphazardly, ein ze ki im roalev. This is pure evil. Shilaya inyan hazima benashim miruchak beenav. The notion that the sexual abuse of his daughters should not have been an abomination in his own eyes, should not have been perceived in his own eyes as something terrible. And that he wasn't doing anything violent, he wasn't abusing, he wasn't mistreating his daughters in any way. This clearly demonstrates to us a perversion and corruption of an entire value system. It gives us a very good insight into Lot. On the one hand, Lot is Avram's nephew. And until the story of Lot's daughters, until the story of Lot's conversation with the people of Sdom, the only context we have of Lot is that he follows Avram around. And then finally, after Avram comes back from Mitzrayim, he and Avram's shepherds, his shepherds and Avram's shepherds, have a little bit of a dispute over the land of Israel. Lot chooses the Arei Kikar, and Avram stays in the land of Israel. Beyond that, we know nothing about him. The first real encounter we see of Lot and his personality is here, and what you see is a glaring contradiction. He's trying to imitate Abraham's hospitality, at least on a superficial level, but in the core of his being, he's much more corrupt, perhaps even along the lines of the people of Sodom. It's no surprise that he picked the city of Sodom. So far, everybody with me?
Yeah.
L'chach amuch rabotenu b'noag sheb'olam adam moser atzmo al b'notav ve'al ishto v'yoreg o neherag. Therefore, our sages in the Medrash and Medrash Tanchuma say the following. It is the way of the world, noag sheb'olam. It is normal, intuitive, instinctive, that a person will sacrifice himself to protect his wife and his children and his daughters. Allow himself to be killed or even kill in order to protect the integrity of his wife and daughter. This Lot Moser b'notav lehitolel behem. He offered his daughters that they should be violated. Now listen to the end of this medrash. Amar lo Kadosh Baruch Hu le'atzmecha ata mishamran. Said a Kadosh Baruch Hu to Lot, or about Lot, in the end, these daughters, you've protected them for you. Meaning? It's almost measure for measure. A punishment to Lot for his behavior, that's almost measure for measure. What happens to Lot and his daughters?
When he gets thrown, the whole story.
Right? What happens to Lot and his daughters is that he ends up in this cave in the city of Tzoar, and his daughters
violate him.
Measure for measure. Mean to connect me. That's what the Medrash says. It's really a remarkable statement of our sages. And incredibly insightful, because they understood what had taken place in the story was a terrible perversion. Now, so far so good, right?
Yeah. The fact that this happens twice.
Well, he's going to get to that in a second.
Okay. But is that culture? Is that the culture around them? That's
we're talking about twice in the course of. I'll tell you exactly how many years. 400, 300, 700. We're talking about 800 years later.
Okay.
Well, actually, no, that's not true. We're talking about anywhere between 500 and 700 years later.
But I think I asked you this in the culture at the time: were women just chattels?
In certain societies, I would probably have to say yes. Okay. Certainly not in a value system that we would uphold.
Right, but I'm saying, would this have happened in the greater community?
It could have. It's possible. Certainly, we don't know of incidents, but okay. Not beyond the realm of reason.
Right.
Why was Lot so afraid of them? Lot was afraid of them. Lot was protecting them. Who's the them?
Yes.
He was protecting his guests. He didn't need to really protect them because they're angels, but he thought that they were human beings. That's the whole source of the problem. When the guests were able to smite the people of Sodom with blindness, and they said that we are destroying the city, then suddenly he realized, then he realized that they're dealing with malachim and not with people, so he changed his tune a little bit. But at the first, the outset, we need to understand that the reason why Lot made this offer was because he really thought he was dealing with two innocent guests, and Nebuchadnezzar had to find some way to protect them, and did so in a way that was, on the one hand, understandable in context of the people of Sodom, maybe perverted objectively, but he was dealing with that culture.
Does he get any credit for that part in itself?
Or trying to protect his guests?
Does he get
gets the credit of having in some way tried to emulate Abraham's value of Achnasat Achim, but he survives, so Chazal say he survives on Avraham's
shoulder.
Merit. Right. Not on his own merit. And the proof is that he ends up being the father of the nations of Ammon and Moab, who are existential and eternal enemies of the Jewish people. So, you know, how much of a schus that is, I don't know. Except for maybe Rus, who redeems their quality.
You say that they abused him. Isn't
they abused
when the daughters abused him? Isn't it? For some reason, it's in my head. Someplace.
Didn't they abuse him? They violated him.
Violated him.
The difference.
Some reason it's in my head. Some story that like he actually knew what was going on.
Unclear. They in the text it says that he got them drunk. They got him drunk.
They got him drunk.
They gave him wine. They got him drunk.
So, okay.
Now we get to the part where he compares the two stories. He says, now remember, this is the Ramban and Chumash. So the Ramban is assuming that, and as many of the Mefarshim do, you know, one of the problems with the way we read Mefarshim is that we don't know Tanakh the way they did. So we are working off the assumption that we have a text in front of us, and the Parish is trying to explain, Parshan is trying to explain the text. The Parshanim were working off the assumption that you know the rest of Tanakh by heart. And therefore, the comparison is already in your head. You've already made this connection to the story of Pelegesh. So he's now going to explain the differences. He says, Veda, Vehaven, no, understand. Ki inyan Pelegesh begiva, af al pi shehu nidme le inyan hazeh, Pelegesh begiva, even though it is similar to this story, enenu kamoho leroa. It's not as bad. Says the Ramban, the story of Lot and his offer was worse than the story of the Zaken and his offer. In a moral, objective moral system, as I said, to compare the two evils, which is the lesser evil, says the Ramban, the lesser evil, he claims, is the story of the Anshei Giv'ah. That's the question. Ultimately, he's going to try to defend that position. And that's the question that we are going to try to explore, and perhaps even kvodobim kumo munach, maybe even challenge. Well, so again, let me clarify that. The issue is the comparison of Lot's behavior to the Zaken's behavior. Mm-hmm. For now. Now we'll see beyond that. Okay? The husband's behavior is a different issue.
Okay.
Ki, harishaim ha'em, those wicked people, lo hayad da'atam l'chalot ha'regel mimkomam. Their intent, those wicked people referring to the people of Giva, right, they had a local intent. They had the desire for this man and his Pelegesh. But their intent wasn't a broader global effort to rid the city of any guests. The xenophobia that was characteristic of Sodom was not at their part of their motivation. They were lustful, as is not uncommon in societies, in any society. They wanted the man. They wanted to sexually abuse the man too. Homosexuality was part of the culture. And the proof is that when the man threw out his pilagesh, the people of Giva were satisfied, they were appeased, and they went away. In other words, indicating that the sin was lust, but it wasn't a broader societal goal of xenophobia, of ridding the society of any outsider. Right, this Isha Zaken who offered his daughter and this other guy's Pilagesh. Here the Ramban says something which I'm not quite sure how he knew this, but he claims. He knew that they wouldn't take his daughter. They wouldn't want his daughter. And they would never harm his daughter. So it was a idle offer. The Akein lo avu lishmalo. That's why they didn't want to listen to him, because they weren't going to be satisfied with it. They wanted him. They didn't want her. When the Levi threw out his pilagash, so at that point they were appeased and they left him alone. Ve'aish bal habayit, the gam ha'oreach, kulam ayu chavatzim latzil et ha'ish b'filagsho. The bal habayit and the oreach, they had the same intent, which was to save this oreach, the Levi, by at the expense of the pilagash. So now I'll explain to you, says Ramban, why that wasn't as bad as the story of Lot. Ki pilagash hayta lo eshet ish present alav. Pilagash wasn't blameless. She was already guilty of having committed adultery. So to him, to the ish, she was already a pilagash that wasn't faithful. So okay, so she's not faithful. So
and that's society.
Where was?
She was already adulterous.
It says so at the beginning of the story. Vatiznea lav pilagsho. No, it says Vatiznea lav pilagsho. The story starts.
She
runs away. But the story starts clearly. Perek Yud Tet. Vayikach lo isha pilagish from Bet Lechem Yehuda. Man takes his pilagish from Bet Lechem Yehuda. Vatiznea lav pilagsho. And his pilagish was unfaithful to him. Vatelech meito. And then she ran away from him and went to her father's house. So, depending on how I understand the phrase, but the story clearly starts with some comment about her committing some kind of violation of the fidelity of the marriage. We tried to soften the blow a little bit by suggesting that he's really an abusive husband, so you know, maybe she was trying to run away, whatever it was. But at least in the way the story begins, the first offense is committed by her, at least. On the text, on the level of what the text says. So says the Ramban. Okay, so that explains the behavior. It does not exonerate or justify the behavior. Don't misread the Ramban. Ramban is not justifying the behavior. He's suggesting that, okay, so I understand the mentality, the mindset a little bit more than Lot. Lot, really, what did these two daughters do? They did nothing. He just offered them to the wolves for no good reason. Whereas in the case of the Pilagash, she was already questionable or suspect in their eyes.
Was already worthless as far as the culture was concerned at the time.
We don't know that. We don't know more than his behavior. To extrapolate beyond that to the culture is an extension that's not in the text. We don't necessarily have any indication of that. We know his behavior. His behavior is clearly problematic. But beyond that, we don't have any indication. And we know their lustful behavior, the people of Giv'ah, but we don't have any indication that there's a broader status of women issue in this story. Abusive husbands are not a story unique to the world of Giv'ah of Binyamin. It doesn't necessarily mean that society as a whole exonerates or believes in that vice.
So this translation, of course, is...
What does it say?
It says she deserted. Yes.
It says after that. It says Vatiznela Pilaksho, there's two phrases there. It says Vatiznela Pilaksho Vatelech Meito al Betavia. What does it say before she deserted him? What's the phrase just before she deserted him and went to her father's house?
He married a concubine wife. That they don't.
They clean it up a little bit. That may be Rashi's explanation, that her violation was in her deserting him and nothing more, but it's unclear. And the text clearly uses the word znut, which...
Zana.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Coming back to the Ramban, more paragraphs in the Ramban.
That makes a little more sense.
In English says that his concubine was faithless to him and went away from him to her father's house.
Okay, so what does faithless mean? Yeah. Does faithless mean that she left, that's why she was faithless? Or that she violated something that therefore caused her to run away?
Well, that changes, but I mean, there's a big difference there, I think.
That's true, doesn't, 100%. Okay, next paragraph. Now, next distinction between Sodom and Lot. Between Sodom and Giv'ah. But Peretzahu, when we're talking about the breach that took place in the story of Giv'ah, this breach, od lo ayu bo kol anshe ha'ir, it wasn't an all-inclusive everybody of the city. Kasher b'ston. And it didn't include everybody. So you had a group of perpetrators, because the text says, Shenemar bo minav yad zaken kol la'am mikatzeh. That's what I showed you before. In Sdom, if I compare the two psukim. But the moment I have an omission that's so glaring, it's significant. Right? By In Sdom, the Torah goes out of the way to tell me, kol anshei ha'ir minav yad zaken. Here it just says, anshei ha'ir anshei ben Yilel. From the people of the city, there was a people that were worthless and evil. Does that mean that everybody in the city? Doesn't say that. If it says everybody in Sdom, I understand that's everybody. If I say a group of people of anshei Givah, that doesn't necessarily mean everybody. And therefore, I can assume that there's a smaller number involved in the story. Why is it significant? Because it means that we're not dealing with a cultural, city-wide perversion. We're dealing with a group of people. There are always evil people in every generation. Miktzatam, a group of them. They may have been leaders, they may have been forceful, they may have been strong, they may have been a significant power gang in the city. As it says, Kumo Shemar Ha'ish Ve'akumu Alai Ba'alei Giv'ah, members, people of the Giv'ah, the Ba'alei Giv'ah, the leadership perhaps. The others didn't protest because they may have been stronger. They may have been the bullies of the city that have a stranglehold on others. Unclear. Now, if you remember, we saw the beginning of the drums of war beating. All the people of the tribes, after they get their parcel in the mail, they come pounding, ready to go to war against the people of Giv'ah. The people of the tribes of Israel, they wanted to do something, they wanted to kill the people of Giv'ah. Now, what basis do they have to kill the people of Giv'ah? As it says, give us the people of Giv'ah, give us the perpetrators, and we'll kill them. What basis do you have to kill them? Were they guilty of a capital offense? The Devar Baruhu, says the Ramban. This is the critical line. It says, Devar Baruhu, Shelo hayu chayavim mita b'din Torah. According to Torah law, the people of Givah did nothing that would make them guilty of a capital offense, guilty of a death penalty. Right? Even
though she died.
Well, we're going to see that in a second. But even in civil law today, I don't think, if you had a similar case, I don't think you would be able to, even in places that have a civil, have a capital punishment still in force, I'm not sure that there's enough significant evidence to suggest that you could hold them accountable for her death. Rape, yes. But rape is not a capital offense. Maybe in today's society they could be charged with some sort of manslaughter offense, but not a capital first-degree murder. Shelo asu maaseh zulati inui apilegesh asana. They raped her, they violated her. But that's not a capital offense. That's an offense. Lo nitkavnu lemita. They didn't intend for her to die. There's no premeditated murder here. V'gamlo meta biadam, nor did she die in their hands. When she left them, and this is true even legal, this is true even today in civil society, when she left them, she was alive. And therefore, there's no evidence that would convict them in any kind of court. When she left them, she was alive. V'yishalchu, for murder. But the issue is, they wanted to kill them. So they can only kill them if they're guilty of a capital offense, which would be murder. They sent her, she was alive. Then she went home, and then she died. So, even from a civil legal perspective, the moment she left them and she was alive, they, it's hard pressed to be able to charge them with first degree murder. You might be able to charge them with manslaughter, maybe, second degree, but certainly not something that would carry a capital offense. It's possible that she was so weakened by their abuse of her all night long that she ultimately died in the morning, but go prove that in the court. However, Mipnesha, you chafatzim biomrim lasot nevala, ke anshe Sodom. However, since the people of Giva had intended to perpetrate an evil equal to the evil of Sodom, the behavior was Sodom-like, and that's the purpose of the parallel and the comparison to Sodom. Ra'u ha-shvatim la'asot siyag la'Torah. The Shvatim acted in a way they wanted to make a fence around the Torah. They wanted to go beyond the letter of the law. The letter of the law doesn't allow them to kill the people of Giva. It's not a capital offense. But they wanted to stop this breach in its place by going beyond that. Shelo ya'asu v'lo ya'amer can be Yisrael, that such a thing should not happen in Israel. Nivara ra'a be Yisrael. And therefore, and he even talks about Sanhedrin, a rule in Sanhedrin that a Beit Din has the right to punish even beyond what the Torah allows in order to maintain some kind of protection of the value system of the community. Then he goes on to suggest that the people of Benjamin wanted to protect the people of Giva, and then the rest of the story will unfold. We'll talk about the rest of the Ramban at another time. So essentially the Ramban tries to argue, and he does so in the last paragraph, explicitly suggest that they were unjustified in trying to kill the members of Giv'ah. That's why they lost the battle the first time around. We'll see that next time. But ultimately he says, in the comparison between the behavior of the Zaken, the Levi, and the Anshe Giv'ah, all behaving in a Sodom-like manner, but compared to the story of Sodom, their behavior was not as bad. Now what's driving the Ramban to go out of his way to demonstrate that their behavior was evil, but not as evil as the people of Sodom? In what ways are they different? So he says, first of all, it's only a portion of the city. Second of all, their goal isn't a city-wide xenophobic get rid of any guests in the city. The goal is particularly is personal lust behavior, gang-like behavior. So that there's no pattern here, it's just particular evil people. And thirdly, the offer of the daughter was not a serious offer, you knew they wouldn't accept it. And the Pilegesh was maybe not completely innocent in the first place. And fourthly, there's no capital offense here, because they didn't kill her. And therefore, from all these perspectives, the people of Israel were unjustified in trying to kill the people of Giva. What's driving the Ramban's need to not justify, but lower the level of the offense of the people of Giva? Excuse me?
Make them look better.
Make them look not as evil. Right? Not as evil. Remember, he's not exonerating them. He's changing the nature of the offense, let's call it from first degree murder to manslaughter and rape. Okay? So that doesn't make them off the hook. It just means that you can't kill them. Right? There's a difference. And in any court that difference is very clear. What's driving the Ramban's need to make that distinction clear?
So what happens in the future?
Right. So I think that what's driving the Ramban is the notion that when Israel goes to war with Bnei Binyamin, ultimately the tribes lose the first round. As if to say that in some way their war was unjustified. I'll come back to that issue next week. But I have a simple question. Objectively, where do we put this Ramban? You'll forgive me for asking a question which you're really not allowed to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do we agree or disagree with the Ramban's assessment of the people of Giv'ah and the behavior involved in a stone-like fashion? Was it really not as bad as stone?
Somehow, to me, the way you asked the question means that the other was really worse.
Which was worse? Pilegesh or stone?
No, stone.
Certainly the Ramban wants to argue that stone was much worse. And I think that it's hard-pressed to argue with Ramban. I think that the nature of the events are such that there's certainly a lot of Sodom-like behavior. Let's call it, so let's say the Ramban argues, put numbers to it, if Sodom is at 100% evil, this is 85% Sodom-like. Just enough to take it off a capital offense. Because 85%. Still 85%, but it's 85%.
Because there are fewer people involved, it's not an entire city. But my question is, why do we have to make that judgment?
Well, so that's what I asked before. What's driving the Ramban to do that? What's motivating the Ramban is an enormous question we're going to have to get to, which is when they finally go to war against Binyamin, by God's decree, they lose the first round. They ask God, they ask the Urim V'Tumim, the Kohen Gadol says they should go to war, and they lose the first round. It's the first time the Urim V'Tumim misleads them.
So that's the future oriented.
Right. Well, that's, you know, it's the next paragraph in the story, and so the Ramban, knowing that, says, okay, clearly, therefore, the war was unjustified. If God sent them into a trap, so to speak, clearly the war had to have been on some theological level unjustified. If it was a war against Sodom, God destroyed Sodom. If destroying Binyamin or Giv'ah was unjustified, so there had to have been a reason why we need to step back from the brink. That's what's driving the Ramban. He says it very clearly. But there's still a fundamental issue here that I think the Ramban is not addressing.
Yeah. The results in Giv'ah were worse than the results in
Sodom,
because the angels could take care of those guys themselves. They could blind them, they could whatever. But and here, a woman, tainted or not tainted, gives up her life because these people are, you know, out of their minds. The other thing is
nobody's
idea of collective guilt. Like, okay, let's say there's these Biryanim that are like whatever, 85% of the city roaming around doing these terrible things, but the good people are, you know, by living there, are agreeing to it.
Would you hold them accountable in a court of law and kill them for it? Seriously. I mean, it's very easy to be critical of it in a story, but think about it objectively. If this took place in a city, would you take every member of the city and execute them because that they sat quietly and let this happen? You're the judge and jury. Would you execute every member of the city for what they did?
No.
Especially the ones who weren't involved, just because they didn't, not only did they not stop them, but they refused to hand over, extradite the perpetrators. Would you go and execute them all? That's what happened with you. It was a war against the entire city of Givas. As Ramban says, such a war is unjustified. Objectively.
They still lucked out by two circumstances here. One, she didn't die right away.
Correct.
She may have had only a period of 3 hours or whatever, or 4 hours.
So, it's in a court of law, that happens all the time. In court, that happens all the time.
How did that father really know that they weren't going to do anything to the daughter?
In the end, his motivation here is irrelevant, because you can't punish somebody for motivation. You can only punish something for what happens. And what happens is rape, but not murder. Or at least not first-degree murder.
It was an isolated case. I mean,
and that's what the Ramban is arguing. It's an isolated case, and not an anshei Sodom. It's not a citywide characteristic moral issue. Can't blame everybody. And therefore, how do you...
The woman also talked about Levi's part in the whole thing.
True. We don't know what happens to... We do not know what happens to this Levi. Whether he goes to war and he dies in the first battle or not, I have no idea. We do not know what happens to him. But that's where the Ramban is at. But I think the Ramban has missed one critical piece.
Oh, I can't wait.
I think it's one critical piece. I don't disagree with the Ramban that I think ultimately the war was unjustified, but the Ramban, I think, has still missed one critical piece of information.
And that was?
Well, you tell me.
I don't know. We're all waiting to hear.
You tell me. Compare the people of Givah to the behavior of Sodom. Let's assume for the moment, put it in numerical terms, the people of Sodom are equal 100% evil, the people of Givah equal to 85% evil. After I finish all the comparisons to Sodom.
That none of the good people in Givah took these strangers in, just
That's very Sodom-like. That's very Sodom-like, right? So their behavior is Sodom-like. Okay. Therefore.
of the city didn't come to protest.
The rest of the city is guilty of the same kind of Sodom-like behavior. Nobody took this Levi in, right? Sitting in the middle of the street, nobody took him in. They're all behaving like a bunch of Sodom. Right? Mm-hmm. So what's the key difference between the two stories that we haven't identified, neither in my chart nor in the Ramban?
That there were some good people in Kiva?
That there weren't some. So even the
not letov, not letovatam, not letovatam, letovatam. Not for the ben, not to the to for the benefit. If I told you that a city in Israel was compared to Sodom, what would you tell me?
What do you mean, a city to the, a city?
We're talking about Giv'ah or Shevet Binyamin.
Yeah, would recommend visiting them.
Wouldn't have them on your most desired list.
What we're missing, what we're missing is that we're not talking about two Canaanite cities comparing two Canaanite cities. We want to talk about two Canaanite cities. One is evil 100%, and one is evil 85%. I don't care. But we're talking about the city of Giv'ah of Shevet Binyamin. The very notion that you could take a city of Israelites of a Shevet in Israel and compare their behavior to Sodom. I don't care if it's 20% evil. But we miss the key piece of the story, which is we're talking about an Israelite city. How did we reach the point where B'nai Yisrael are behaving like Sodom? I don't care if the evil is 30%, 40%. The comparison is horrific. It wrenches at the gut because we're talking about the Shevet B'Yisrael behaving like the people of Sodom. The Churban HaMikdash took place because of that. That's the piece of this story that
and the lady went out of his way to get you at the gut. Not to stop.
He really had this thing for this lady, right?
He didn't want to stop at the Canaanite city.
100%. He didn't want to stop at the Canaanite city because he knew they wouldn't give him.
They wouldn't give him house.
Right? Hospitality. So he went to a Jewish city. And he found the behavior Sodom-like.
Right.
Sodom-like. Every Navi in the history of Israel who wants to tell a city of whoever it is, whether it be Ammon or Moab or behavior of Mitzrayim or Edom or even B'nai Israel, that their behavior has reached the point of the bottom of the bottom of the bottom, says that's you're behaving like right. Sodom and Amar. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no worse indictment. So we can argue back and forth whether they were guilty of a capital crime, not guilty of a capital crime, whether there was room for... But in the end, the moral issue here is not the behavior of the particulars of the story, but the notion that I can have a city of Israel compared to Sodom and sit back and it wrenches at your gut. That's really, I think, the purpose of this whole comparison is to tell us here, you were not talking about Sodom, outside, Canaanite, sitting on the, and Hashem brought down fire and brimstone and destroyed the city. We're talking about a Jewish city. So if the fire and brimstone didn't come from God, it came from the rest of B'nai Israel.
So when I asked you if these are the two cities that are the worst, so we're only talking about one in Israel that was.
We're talking about one particular. Is it possible that there are more, that the story is a sort of paradigm of a phenomenon that has crept into the land as a whole, and therefore our worry is much more extensive than just one Shevet?
Right, that's sort of what I would say.
I think that the answer would have to be yes, because this is the seal on Sefer Shoftim. This is the crowning jewel with which the story of Sefer Shoftim, the era of Sefer Shoftim, ends. Just to leave us on a kind of happy-go-lucky foot.
That's not a crown.
That's right. No, I'm being facetious, but that's exactly the point. So I think that there is something about the story which is indicative of a moral degradation, degeneration that has crept into the country as a whole. And if we're talking about a country that is compared, or cities in the country that are compared to Sodom, we're in serious trouble. To give you an example, 5 minutes left, I'll just show you. Excuse me?
Who else sees that? Them. Does anyone realize them?
That their behavior is Sodom-like?
It's fickle. I mean, are there other Mephoshim that...
Well, all the Mephoshim compare the story of the Givat to Sodom. That comparison is just begs itself out of the text. I'm going to have to look. I think this notion that a city of Israel could behave like Sodom,
what I mean.
I think that there's, I don't know if I've seen it inside, but I think it's sort of intuitive almost from the...
Well, I mean, we need you to show us that. But my point is, now that we're told,
right,
it's abominable.
Right. 100%. The whole story is correct. And the results of this story are abominable. They get wiped out. Givat gets wiped out. Binyamin gets wiped out. 50,000 people on both sides of this war die. It's an enormous, enormous tragedy. And ultimately, that's part of the message. If you take a look, just briefly, I'll show you a couple of examples so you can see the extent to which Sodom v'Amorah hovers over Tanakh as a constant threat. On the last page of this source page, I collected from various nivuot throughout Tanakh, and I'm not going to go through them all because we only have 3 minutes or 4 minutes left, but I'll just show you Yeshayahu in his critique of Bavel. Remember, Bavel is the nation that ultimately will destroy the Beit HaMikdash, where he talks about the evil of Bavel and ultimately the fact that Bavel will be punished for it. He says, "Vayta Bavel tzvi mamlachot tiferet gaon kazdim ki mapechat Elokim et Sodom ve'et Amorah." Bavel, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans, shall be as God overthrew Sodom and Amorah. This is Yeshayahu, 500 years later. This is Sodom and Amorah hovers over the whole period of Tanakh as a constant theme. Yirmiyahu to Edom, Tzvanya to Moab, which is particularly significant. In the middle paragraph, he says, "Lachen chay ani nu'um Hashem tzvakot elokei Yisrael ki Moav ki Sodom tiyeh ubnei Amon ka Amora." Moav will be like Sodom, Amon will be like Amora. Why is it particularly significant to compare Amon and Moav to Sodom and Amora? Why is that a particularly painful accusation? Because who are Amon and Moav? Amon and Moav are the two children born from Lot and his daughters. So, talk about history repeating itself. You know, that notion.
Yeah, but then what do you do with Ruth?
So that's part of the whole story of Megillat Ruth, is try to understand her exception to the issues of Moav. Take a look at the Psukim in Devarim. Psukim in Devarim are very telling because this is a description of in Chumash, Bashat Nitzavim, where Hashem describes the Chorban that will take place if Israel sins to the point where the people will destroy, the land will be desolated, and the people will go into exile. Mi'amar ador acharon, the generation of your children will come. Ador acharon b'nechem asher yakumu me'achrechem. Second, third generation of your children will look at the exile of Israel and the destruction of everything, of the kingdom. The Gentile that will come from a faraway place. They'll see after all the curses of the Tochacha will take place. They'll see the desolation of the land. The fire and brimstone that will utterly destroy the land to the point where it can't seed anything. It doesn't bear grass and it doesn't bear vegetation. Nothing can grow in it. Like the destruction of Sodom v'Amorah. So in the Chumash already, the paradigm of utter destruction and obliteration which will befall Israel if they sin to the point of the Chorban, is on the paradigm of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, not perpetrated by, not brought out by God directly, but through the exile of Israel. And similarly, the rest of the Nevi'im all point to this same direction. So the notion that you have an Israelite city behaving like Sodom is a paradigm which throughout Tanakh means that the Nevi'im would come along and say, how dare you behave like Sodom? If you behave like Sodom, you know what's going to happen? You'll be destroyed like Sodom. No, what happens to the Givah? They're destroyed like Sodom. That's precisely the point of the comparison. All right, we will stop here.